And believe it or not, while this cathedral was being completed, bring that slide up, this little guy, remember him? This little guy ran around the entire complex, the entire church, several times through his youth. Many of you would probably want me to keep that slide up for the entirety of the sermon. How many would like me to take it down now? Okay, listen, I'll make a deal. If we can fit it in and you have a little baby picture, a picture you want to bring, and we'll put that up too, but you got to really make a case for it fitting into the sermon. So, okay, thank you for doing that. I put that up there because my sister-in-law, Bonnie, fixed the crease that I had in it last week. But then I also thought a lot of you would like to see it again, but maybe I was wrong. But here's the backstory to that. Actually, I was a little kid, and I did run around the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. As I've explained a number of times, we live close to Washington, D.C. And in about 1958, in our little town, my mother was very excited. My father was, too. My mother and father were both born in Scotland, as I think I've explained to you several times. Dad grew up in this country. He met Mom during the war, etc. She grew up in Scotland, but a Scottish family, newly emigrated in 1958, moved to our little town, which was so overwhelmingly positive for especially my mother, because now she could speak to somebody with a dialect and accent almost as thick as hers, and so they became fast friends. The Kinnairds in Thurmont, Maryland, had emigrated to the United States in the late 50s, and they had a couple of kids, a couple of children, and they were family friends of ours for the rest of our lives. And I think their son, who's a few years younger than I, eventually became the mayor of my hometown, so that was kind of nice. But the reason we got to roam around, and actually we did, I mean, this was... Of course, everything is big when you're little, as we were, 7, 8 years old. But his father was a stonemason and had learned his craft in Scotland. And a lot of stonemasons of those years came directly from Scotland. And Bob Kinnaird was a craftsman. He was a stonemason. And he was called upon to work on many government buildings. Of course, if any of you have ever been to Washington, D.C., you know that it's replete with lots of stone. And of course, they were finishing the National Cathedral during the late 50s and the early 60s, and that was one of his jobs, working there in the National Cathedral. So occasionally, a couple times, as I remember, he took John, his son, and I to work with him. And what did we do? Well, we ran around the church all day. And so the area in which the president attended a prayer service this past week is an area that I'm very familiar with, at least from memory, as a little kid. I remember us, I didn't really touch it or do anything, but they had the little fountain with holy water and stuff, and never did play with that or do anything. But they had all kinds of interesting nooks and crannies. But it was all stone. It was all marble and granite and everything. It was a beautiful edifice. But that little guy you saw on the screen was there probably creating a little bit more mischief than I'd like to admit to today. But at any rate, I remember seeing that area where they held the service. And you may know, if you watched any of the proceedings, that an Episcopalian minister disrespectfully admonished President Trump to change his mind on various topics which he stated his firm belief on, and falsely accused him of thinking of doing things that he has never intended on doing anyway. So I don't know if any of you watched that, but you may want to go back and take a look at the sermon that was given, and I have to give credit to the president for just sitting there and not having much of an expression or change in expression as he's listening to the admonishment being given to him and the correction. Well, I'd already planned this sermon when I gave last week's sermon on the blessings of Abraham and America's divine providence. But most of the time, most of your speakers will tell you that it's always best to leave the introduction for the last thing. And I hadn't really crafted the introduction to this message, but after viewing the proceedings, this last week, then Marianne Budd helped provide me for the introduction to this sermon today. In this case, it's maybe an example of using a ludicrous, false, distorted narrative to illustrate what is accurate, correct, and honest. Contrast her lies versus the president's truth. Sorry if that offends any of you, but not only are you an illustration, Marianne, as to why the Bible prohibits women from being in the ministry, but you are a liar. Well, that's going to be shocking to a lot of people. Oh, you shouldn't say that. So I would recommend that if this ever makes its way to Ms. Budd, and maybe she spend a little time in reading the Bible and trying to apply it in her own life before she begins lecturing in public a newly elected president. So it brings up the point, what would I do as a minister to encourage the president to do now that he has reclaimed the bountiful blessings that God gave to Abraham? And it's apparent that he recognizes, even if he doesn't understand, those blessings of Abraham have come to us and been transplanted through the years and ended up at the feet of the American people. It's obvious that at least he understands the principle that our nation has got great wealth. It's under our feet. It's in the form of oil and minerals and untapped resources. And all we have to do is get out of the way and let private enterprise and let the people be able to take advantage of that. And he has mentioned that several times this week. So let's review. Now, I may be wrong on this, okay? I may be totally incorrect, but we're going to turn to Genesis chapter 22 and verse 17 and review a vital key to understanding the Bible, a vital key to Bible prophecy and being a good Bible student. I've hammered this particular theme over the years. I'm going to continue to talk about it. I think it's very, very important. Because in Genesis 22 and verse 17, it repeats a promise that God made to Abraham and elaborates on that promise. He says, "In blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies." And that was very often in our booklets, the United States and British Commonwealth and Prophecy, where it shows that the descendants of Israel would possess vital sea gates and mountain gates and have the opportunity to direct the world and commerce and everything else and be a protective nature for the rest of the world as well. "And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." And so we always known as a church, and all the other churches of God realize this as well, and that's great, that these national blessings and the birthright blessings that were given to Abraham have, through the centuries, been passed down to the generations. And finally, they really came to fruition at the time of around the 1800s. And last week after the sermon, I got a request from someone online that said, why did it take so long for these blessings to come in? And you know, I just explained that Leviticus mentions that to the original nation of Israel, which we'll get into, the 12 tribes, that if they were disobedient to his law and they didn't fully drive out the inhabitants of the land that he had given to Israel, then they would have seven times punishment. And we've applied the year for a day principle, seven times 360-day year is 2,520 years. And you take that from the time of Israel's captivity, and it gets this where, you know, wow, so much detail. You take that from the time of Israel's captivity in 721 and 718 BC, and you end up around the year 1800. And that's when the emergence of the British Empire really began, and the emergence of the United States as a nation with the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, and just setting the stage for the United States to become a fabulously wealthy nation, which Mr. Trump has been speaking of. So, as the newly elected president assumed his duties this past week, and I'll explain where it's possible that I could be totally wrong, okay? So, but I begin with a premise, and until that premise is proven wrong, then I'm just going to fly with it. But again, I'll explain that. The newly elected president assumed his duties this week, And he began the task of at least attempting to dismantle what is some have called the deep state, some have called the swamp. I think that President Trump certainly referred to it as the swamp during his first presidency. He put the New World Order, the UN, the WHO, the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, and a lot of other globalist groups who really have wanted to get together and have some kind of human world government and dissolve nation states. And one of the things they'd have to do, of course, is to make sure the United States is not so important, and that's what they have been. That's what their plan has been. It's in their stated goals. It's in their white papers and no borders, you know, allow people to migrate everywhere and et cetera, et cetera. And we've had the problems in Europe and the United States because of some of these attitudes and directives. But he even addressed the World Economic Forum, which is kind of a group of the world's wealthiest people that get together every week in the mountain town of Davos, Switzerland, and they begin to talk about how they want to see the future evolve. And basically, the way they want the future to evolve is people eating bugs and reducing the population down to about 500 million people. Stated goals, you can look it up. Do you realize that in 2020, when President Trump left office, this is speaking about some of the blessings that he is talking about that we have. Now, I don't know who the oldest person here is in the room necessarily. Well, maybe I do, but some of you remember when gasoline was like 25 cents a gallon, 30 cents a gallon. When I started driving, lower than that, okay, 27 cents, 20 cents, okay, whatever, they have gas wars and they'd be paying you to take the gas, I know, but gas was relatively cheap, and, you know, the old-timers will say, I remember when gas was 15 cents a gallon. Well, I don't know if it's ever that cheap, but anyway. Do you realize that when President Trump left office, gas, buying at the pump, was the cheapest, let me explain, the cheapest it has ever been in this nation? Do you realize that? Let me explain. Because of inflation and because of understanding inflation, okay, some of you said, okay, it was less, you paid less for a gallon of gas than 25 cents or 30 cents, but bear with me, I'm not far wrong. At 28 to 30 cents a gallon in 1955, we're making a few assumptions. Today, that would be between 330 and 350 per gallon, or actually in 2020's dollars, because the inflation has been raging since then. So that means that for the 4 years of the Trump presidency, we were paying less than anybody else has for a gallon of gas in history. Because although the gas is higher, everybody's wages are a lot higher than they were in 1955 or 1960 or whatever point you want to point to and say that. So let me know when you pay less than $2 a gallon in the future, and it's possible that you will, because there will be more incentive to drill, baby, drill, and it'll be a lot better for all of us when gas gets under $3 a gallon, $2.50 a gallon, and who knows where it will finally settle. But the point I'm making is that the change in the last week has been breathtaking. It has been dizzying. There were the January 6 hostages, over 1,500 of them that were released, an incredible, crazy thing where people were put in prison for over 4 years, many of them, without ever being charged. There are many of them held in a D.C. jail, which is one of the worst in the world, according to some. It was very heartwarming and tear-jerking to see the expression of some of these folks when they were interviewed as they came out of jail, and they were not vindictive. They've been in prison for 4 years, many times put in solitary confinement for months at a time. That is enough to drive somebody crazy, but they were so thankful when they got out. And many of them simply had been walking in the Capitol, and now we know that
Oh, of course, records have been destroyed purposefully, I believe. I have to be careful exactly what we say here, but the records of the investigation of that time have been destroyed. Nobody knows where they are. They're all gone. And coincidentally, the outgoing president pardoned many of those members of that commission so that they couldn't be tried for their crimes. That's unfortunate. But those poor people, innocent, many of them, while a lot of the problems that were actually caused at the Capitol at that time were done, we know, by agents that provoked attacks even on the police sometimes. But enough of that. The January 6 hostages were released. A lot of people were very happy about that. Right to Life people who protested, may have been standing across the street from an abortion clinic, were arrested and put in jail under the previous administration. Over 20 of them, I think 26 or so. People who want to protect the sanctity of life being put in prison. Can you imagine that that actually happened in the United States of America? People that were nonviolent, grandmothers, some of them in some cases. It is hideous. And then the beautiful address to the World Economic Forum from Washington, D.C., the president basically told everybody that, you know, the United States is going to go on in this particular direction. He basically answered a few questions from some of the, they weren't really world leaders that were on a stage at that time, but he answered their questions and basically reiterated his policies without apology. And he made it known, and I don't know if he knows from the biblical standpoint, but this is what I would be telling him. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 49 and verse 24. In the earlier part of, in the end of chapter 48, the patriarch Jacob at this time had pronounced a blessing above the other brothers to the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's reiterated here in this particular passage in Genesis, the end of Genesis. In Genesis 49 and verse 24, it's speaking of Joseph or Joseph's sons. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath. And it's not specifically mentioned all those things, but it could be speaking of mineral wealth, it could be speaking of oil. And for most of us, when we went to school and we were taught about oil, especially prior to the energy crisis of the 70s, and those of us who went to school in the 50s, we were taught that oil came from decaying dinosaurs. That's what we were taught. That was science. And it's actually a renewable source, they have found. And it just keeps bubbling up to the surface, and man has found ways to extract more of it. And we've got apparently more of it than any other place in the world. In this country, when they all said back in the 70s, we're running out. And it wasn't true. And I remember watching a geologist on one of the business channels about 20, 25 years ago, right when they were beginning to develop fracking. And this individual was from Colorado, and he said, I realized that our nation was great because of God. He says, I've always believed in that. And he said, I never believed, after going through as a kid myself through the energy crisis of the 70s, I never believed that God would leave us without the energy we needed as a nation. And when I saw that report 20, 25 years ago, I thought, that is amazing that somebody sees that and recognizes that. And it was so inspiring to see that petroleum engineer make that comment. But going on in Genesis, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. So even though the ancestors would have great blessings, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were all wealthy men, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him, that is Ephraim and Manasseh, who was separate from his brothers. So all of the nations are blessed. All of those 12 tribes are blessed because they're the sons of Jacob, but these two especially. And now, at this time in history, especially the United States of America. So Jacob got a separate, an additional blessing above his brothers, and those blessings can be traced to the British Empire and America, Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, the president in his first term, back in 2016, 2017, when he finally came to office, realized a lot of these things, not from a biblical perspective, but just from a business perspective. But the impediment in his first administration were a lot of people who were enemies of his agenda. Because what we find has been a part of government systems, that the Argentinian president has discovered this and has turned his nation around. Javier Milei turned Argentina around. They have begun to balance their budget. They've wiped out deficits they've had for years. It's an incredible turnaround. He's implemented many of the same policies that our president wants to implement. But there were many enemies in the first term, and oftentimes many enemies in his own party. Subterfuge, and because when you get down to following the money in this situation, you find out why people get aligned. President Trump, a billionaire, doesn't even take a salary, didn't in his first term, donated to charity, didn't care about that. What he cares about is America, but he's turning on the oil spigot, but he's cutting off the cash flow spigot to a lot of deep state actors. But in the last 8 years, he figured out how to beat them. Now, it just gets down to getting down in the trenches, and that's what they did, and it's on so many levels. But they have discovered how to beat back some of the global interests, and now it's game on. There's going to be competition between this. It's going to be yin and yang, pulling, tugging a war. But let's go back to the beginning of the inheritance and see what lessons we can learn about Israel as it comes into the promised land, into the land of Canaan. Let's just review here a little bit and take a look at the beginning of the inheritance under a great leader, a dynamic leader, maybe the George Washington or the Abraham Lincoln of his day. A man of great courage. Let's turn to Joshua chapter 1 and verse 2. Moses had set an incredible example for Joshua. Moses is called in the previous chapter, going back to Deuteronomy, one of the greatest prophets who ever lived. And God's love for Moses is exemplified in the fact that I don't know if he walked down carrying Moses' body and buried him in the valley from the mountain, or if he simply transported down there, but God took this personal and, shows a great deal of love. But he addresses Joshua in verse 2 of Joshua 1. He says, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all those people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I am about to give you to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so will I be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you." Beautiful words. "Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," meaning those individuals. "Be strong," verse 7, "and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law that my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful." Have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. And Joshua followed that admonition. Joshua was encouraged by that. And they went out and they began very, very well. It's kind of like, it's very reminiscent of the hardships and the difficulties and the inspiration that took place at the founding of this nation. And a couple of days ago, I stumbled upon this, and several others in our family also discovered it independently, but saw an interview by of Ben Carson, and he talked about a story which I had never heard about in American history, and that was the many times that George Washington was actually hit by bullets, but even though in one war, in the French Indian Wars, one Indian chief came to him at the end of his life, and he says, I wanted to see the man that I had shot myself, and all my braves had shot at least 17 times, and he had taken direct hits. But this man was obviously protected by the great power above. And then the Indian chief died. But there were so many times in the Revolutionary War and in the French Indian Wars that George Washington's life was preserved by God. Bullets hit him but did not penetrate or bounced off or whatever they did. They found fragments of bullets in his clothing. And I had never heard that story before, but I was so impressed and knew that God must have protected his life, even as I do believe that God protected the life of Donald Trump in July of this past year, and that he recognizes it is even more important. And in his speech last week, he said, God saved my life so that I could make America great again. Beautiful. If you didn't watch the inauguration speech, on his left hand behind him, all his enemies, which he's calling out unabashedly. It is shocking. People aren't used to being confronted like that, but it's not nice when people try to kill you and people try to destroy you and throw you in jail and derail everything that you've ever done in your life. It's not really bright to just step aside and say, hey, you know, just this has just been fun and games. No, just go ahead and do whatever you want. No, this is a ruthless business. And God told Joshua, you know, don't be discouraged. What a great thing. So when you go through the book of Joshua, which we won't today, but you'll see that Joshua defeated 31 kings and their cities. They're listed in Joshua 12. You can do a little study on that. That was a vast portion of the land fulfilling God's promise to the Israelites. A lot of people were just driven out. There was one exception, people called the Gibeonites. They deceived Joshua into making a peace treaty with them. They said they'd come from a long ways, and you remember the story, but they kind of faked the whole thing. And then they found out they entered into a peace treaty with them and said, okay, we won't kill you like we're killing all these other people. But when they found out they had been deceived, then they basically made them their servants. And you can read about that in Joshua. And God honored that because a deal is a deal. They made a deal, and God allowed them to do that, and that was fine. And we find that Joshua died at 110 years old, and he challenged and encouraged Israel at his death. And I think that, when you go through this and examine the life of Joshua, I mean, they're all great. I mean, when you read about these patriarchs and you read about these people, they all have life lessons, and God raised them up for certain duties and jobs and obligations, and they fulfilled them. But it's so inspiring to see people become successful because they're obeying God. Isn't it? Isn't it great to reflect in the majesty of these people and how they overcame odds because they relied on God and they relied on his law and they obeyed him? In Joshua chapter 24 and verse 31, It says, Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua, of the elders who outlived him, who had experienced everything that the Lord had done for Israel. Beautiful, beautiful sentiment. But as we know, as the years passed, Israel could not complete its total conquest of the land. And there's a spiritual lesson on these physical problems that happened. Judges chapter 1 shows a very successful at first conquest. But in the second part of the chapter or thereabouts, you find that there were problems. They couldn't completely get the job done. They just couldn't follow through in driving out the people of land, and that caused them problems. And we read in Judges chapter 2, in verse 14, the problems that this caused was because of the religious practices which were in complete contrast to the true, honorable law of God. And it says in verse 11, "Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and serve the Baals." You know, it didn't happen overnight. It happened over a period of years and decades that this summary statement is made from. "And they forsook the Lord, their God of their ancestors who had brought them out of Egypt, and they followed and worshiped various gods of the peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. And in his anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of raiders who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, whom they no longer were able to resist. And whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them. Just as he had sworn to them, they were in great distress." So in this parallel between ancient Israel, which inherited the portion of the blessings of Abraham, and the United States today, then my advice to President Trump, and I would not be presumptuous to try to do that because I think he's already doing it, but if I were given the opportunity and you were, maybe you would understand and realize that half measures are not enough. It's just not good enough to go halfway to the finish line. You've got to finish all the way. Terry's dad, a Texan, had a lot of favorite sayings, and one of his favorite sayings was, "Smite the heathen hip and thigh." It was just, it's not in the Bible, but it was a funny saying that I learned from him many years ago. I think that the president has learned a great deal from his first term, the 4 years after and now, and so many things have happened in the last week. And boy, the month has passed very quickly, right? We're at the end of January already. It's just when things happen so quickly that are positive, the time just flies by. And there's been some beautiful things happening, from getting out of the Paris Accord, which is basically, you know, the United States pay a lot of money for not getting anything in return, and actually you're the lowest polluting nation on the earth per capita. But, you know, just keep paying us and our worthless organizations and societies. But he's out of that, out of the World Health Organization, which is another corrupt bunch. He admonished the European leaders, claimed the Gulf of America. Like, take a fishing trip down to the Gulf of America someday, get some snapper, you know, that'd be nice. Reclaiming the Panama Canal, we're taking it back. Remember those of us in the church during President Carter's term? We're talking about this is one of the blessings of Abraham that God has removed. I mean, that was what we talked about during those years in the late 70s when President Carter handed over the Panama Canal. I mean, it wasn't that God took it away from him. It was Jimmy Carter just gave it away. We still built it. What was it, 40,000 Americans or 40,000 people died under the construction? There wasn't any OSHA back then to stop the, you know, you fall in a pit and get buried or whatever, and they just keep going on. But they built the Panama Canal, and we'll see how that works out. Already, the borders are being swelled down south with people who are self-deporting and people that are being sent home. The action has been very swift. and decisive. Now, let me mention a potential problem for those of us who have been around for so long and followed Bible prophecy in the church, who've grown up in the church, maybe some of you, a potential problem in the outlook. We do have a tendency to ascribe to the notion, but it could all go sideways very quickly. It could all change on this turn of a heel, you know, the flip of the coin, or the prophetic shoe is going to drop somehow, and all this positive news could go awry. Well, that's the way I felt in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. And then, as I've told you, at the end of the 80s, a deacon came to me and said, you know, I think we're going to find that we're going to look back and say the 80s was really good. And you know what? Because of my mind thinking process and my church speak in my head, I didn't enjoy those years as much as I could have. So now my outlook is different. As long as things are positive, I'm going to say, yeah, things are positive. I'm going to enjoy it because that's the way we ought to live our lives anyway. And Mr. Armstrong said that many years ago. You should live your life as though you're just going to live out your natural lifetime. He said this later in his life. Plan your life, organize your life as if you're going to live your life now. But prepare yourself spiritually as if Jesus Christ is going to return at any moment. Always be ready. Don't fall asleep. Don't be like the foolish virgins of Matthew 25. But there's a more personal lesson that I think all of us in the church can take from the incredible, bountiful blessings given to this nation, and which the current administration is rightfully reclaiming. And you can see it. You can see the change in attitude. You can see the outpouring of support when, as a president, he goes to North Carolina and begins to fix things for people and, you know, release the spigots of financial aid to people that need it, when he goes to California and when he promises help and aid. And that roundtable press conference was classic, as there were a few people that wanted to stand up to him and talk back to him and correct him, and he just put them in their place. It was a beautiful thing. These people have gotten away with too much for far too long. Follow the money. Here's the personal lesson that I would like to make regarding us as a body of Christ. America is to lead other nations to treat one another fairly and faithfully, and the president's message to the rest of the world is, you've taken advantage of us, we realize this, we're not going to put up with it anymore, you've treated us like a personal ATM that you can just cash out at any time. We've defended you, we've fought for you, we've given incredible amounts of aid, and this is how you've treated us. Well, it stops now. But what about us? What lessons can we take from the past and the present? The journey that the president is currently on is very similar to the journey and the admonition given to Joshua. Joshua's told to, you know, obey God, to use the law of God in his life and to be motivated by that, to have courage and just move forward. The lesson for us that I believe the New Testament church needs to heed is to drive the type out of our lives that is represented in ancient Israel and that we see in our modern day and age today. I mentioned enemies. The enemies of Israel were easily spotted. They were the people that were in the land already. They were to be driven out. They became the enemies. They became the thorn in the side of Israel that we read about in the book of Judges, where they would take advantage of the people of God. The people of God would not obey God themselves. They would take on the ideas and attitudes of the native peoples. It would ruin them. And then the people would cry out and God would send a judge and deliver them. And they go through a cycle of decades of obedience to God and being led by a righteous judge, and then that judge dies and the people haven't learned the lesson. Well, we as a New Testament church need to heed the call to not take half measures ourselves when it comes to sin. It's easy to spot the flaws of Israel in Judges 1 and 2. And remember, we're getting a summation of what happened over a long period of time. They didn't completely obey God. So whether it's driving out government corruption, as President Trump is trying to do, or driving out personal sin, there can be no halfway measures. It just doesn't work that way. Not in facing a physical foe, and not in even analyzing our own lives and what's present in our own lives. And it's not easy. But the lesson from Joshua and Judges is that if you apply some effort and you rely on God, you can be victorious. You can reclaim that victory. Notice Romans chapter 6 and verse 16. Romans 6 and verse 16, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are the one, you are that one slave whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you have obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered, and having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. Paul said these Roman Christians made the effort. They tried. They didn't give up. They followed through. They had doctrine and law and teaching that helped them to understand their own natures. God provided freedom, and they served God rather than being slaves to falsehood and wrong practice. That's the lesson of ancient Israel. They began to serve other nations, or began to serve other gods of other nations. They forgot the law which had been given to them, and they stopped making the effort. So many times in my ministry, I've encountered individuals who are upset with themselves because they're not perfect and they don't make perfect decisions all the time. And that's just the human condition. But don't ever give up trying. Don't ever stop trying to do the right thing. Allow the doctrine and the law. That's why we've had such a big stress in our local congregation on studying the Bibles ourselves, in our personal lives, reading the Bible, studying it, applying the lessons. Thank you for doing that. I'll bet that President Trump has reflected in the past 5 years about how many people he trusted in his first term that were actually working against him from the beginning of the time that he got into office. The traitors of that first administration are too numerous to mention, but time has revealed how dishonest, how disloyal, and how cunning they were. They're like the nations that Israel was supposed to drive out as they went into the land. Treacherous, laying many traps for he and his administration, and not only that, not just for him, but against us as citizens, against us as Americans. Traitorous individuals fulfilling, at least in part, I think, the prophecy of Paul to Timothy about evil men getting worse and worse and being traitorous and disloyal. That applies to our peoples today. That applies to some of these wretched leaders, many of them who were pardoned in advance of even being prosecuted prior to the end of the last administration. So the premise I have expounded to you in the last two sermons, which I could be totally wrong about, only time will tell. But it's a premise. Let's go with it for a little while. Is that the blessings of Abraham have not been removed from this nation? That's a premise. Now, yeah, have we been plagued by a lot of problems? But Someone at least wants to get rid of a lot of those problems and put people on the right track of obedience. Now, I could be totally off base, and you may disagree, and I could be incorrect, but that doesn't matter as much as the lessons that we are to learn spiritually. We're closing in on the time of year when we're called upon to examine our lives and look for sin. Sin, like idolatrous nations, sin like traitorous enemies, like the deep state, the swamp, the shadow government, they're all hard to get rid of completely. And I don't know if President Trump will be successful in doing that. He's even had in the past week some revelation of deep state actors and people that really don't want his success but want to jump on the bandwagon, I believe, and try to be thought of as being supportive. Hopefully he'll be able to eliminate those as well. Even during the difficult times for the nation of Israel, there were heroes, and you can read about them in the book of Judges, but we'll summarize some of those people that even in difficult times, and I'm adding this because if I'm wrong, if God has begun to remove the blessings of Abraham from this nation, then that's his decision, so be it. But even in difficult times, there can be heroes. You can be a hero. That's why we read in Hebrews 11 and verse 32 of these heroes, so that we can emulate their lives and do character studies of them and understand who they were and what they did. Hebrews 11 and verse 32, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah." All of these were judges in Israel when times were difficult and tough, and they had to have somebody help deliver them. Also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness. Even if times get bad, you can still live your life as a Christian. Remember to drive out sin in your life. Remember to look for sin to begin with and not take any halfway measures. Who obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. The aliens, the oppressors, are the sin that confronts all of us in our own personal lives. We do need to prepare for the Passover and the Spring Holy Day season. It's just 11 weeks away. But my expectation for all of us is that we will have all-out victory with no half measures.